like the plaque on the Statue of Liberty says, give us your tired, your poor, mostly Christians, maybe one or two Indian guys with engineering degrees.
Sounds about right.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio's KPFK in Los Angeles, this is your broadcast as heard on 90.7 FM in LA. In Oregon, 91.7 FM KYAQ on the beautiful Central Coast. 93 FM WLRI in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui. Coast to coast and around the globe on kpfk.org. Of course, on the iTunes and the Stitcher and the TuneIn apps. Streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, on Netroots Radio, on Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, Radio or Not, Radio Free Brooklyn, and Radio Sputnik 5 days a week. Glad you could join us. I am Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow from bradblog.com. Glad to have you here with us for another thrilling, action-packed adventure. Oh, boy, what a week. What a week it has been. We will be speaking in a little bit here with Ian Millhiser and about the new Republican war on regulations. There's a lot going on. There has been, obviously, a lot going on in this country since the attacks in Paris. But there's also sort of this fetishization, if that's a word, of those terror attacks, what we should do about them in this country, what we must do about them in this country, how we must abandon our American values in order to cower in fear or something like that. And in the meantime, there are actually plans being made, things moving forward. There's an election coming up next year. Policy decisions are being either made without, you know, much attention in the media, or they're not being made at all. And perhaps they should be. Perhaps we should not be obsessed with, cowering in fear, as I say. In any event, Ian Millhiser will be here to talk about, he recently attended the Federalist Society's annual convention, where so-called conservative agenda ideas are hatched before they play out in the public space, such as in our legislative bodies and more troubling in our courts, including the Supreme Court, where several Republican appointees are members of this sort of radical right-wing Federalist Society. So Ian Millhiser will be here to discuss his disturbingly headlined article, The Little-Noticed Conservative Plan to Permanently Lock Democrats Out of Policymaking. Really? Yeah, really. He'll be here with us shortly so that we can try and notice that little-noticed plan amidst all the foolish Sturm und Drang in this country in the wake of the Paris terror attacks. In Mali, Islamic extremists armed with guns and grenades stormed the Radisson Hotel in Mali's capital on Friday. Security forces swarmed in to free guests floor by floor. As evening fell on Friday, officials said that there were no more hostages being held, but that at least 19 people had been killed, including two attackers. U.S. and French special operations forces assisted Malian troops in responding to the attacks by an unknown number of gunmen at this time. The shooting continued into the late afternoon, says AP, and a UN official said two attackers were dead. An extremist group led by former Al-Qaeda commander Mokhtar Belmokhtar claimed responsibility for the siege at the Radisson Blue Hotel in the former French colony. Many in France saw it as a new assault on their country's interests a week after the Paris attacks. So there's that. Meanwhile, back in this country, yesterday on this show, we highlighted a Missouri state senator by the name of Mike Moon, I think it was. He called for a special session of the Missouri legislature to, quote, put a stop to the potential Islamization of Missouri. Of course, that's ridiculous and that's not happening, but it hasn't stopped these people from cowering in fear. And then today we'll be happy to move on down to Tennessee, where a GOP leader is now calling for, this is amazing, calling to round up Syrian refugees. A Tennessee Republican lawmaker believes the time has come for the National Guard to round up any Syrian refugees who have recently settled in the state and to stop any additional Syrian refugees from entering Tennessee. We need to activate the Tennessee National Guard and stop them from coming into the state by whatever means we can, said House GOP Caucus Chairman Glenn Quesada, referencing the refugees. So this is, again, this is not some fringe outlier extremist right winger. This is a guy who is the head. He's the House GOP Caucus Chairman in the legislature in the state of Tennessee. Quesada was asked to elaborate on his proposal and whether Tennessee had the authority to detain refugees. He said, Tennessee is a sovereign state. If the federal government is forsaking the obligations to protect our citizens, we need to act, said Quesada during a phone interview with the Tennessean on Tuesday. Tennessean goes on to point out that in fiscal year 2015, only 30 of the 1,601 refugees that settled in Tennessee came from Syria. That's according to the Tennessee Office for Refugees. So just 30. But they need to call out the Tennessee National Guard to round them up. Send them home. Democratic Caucus Chairman Mike Stewart said, I think that is one of the most extraordinarily misguided statements that I've heard made by a public official. He said, we need to approach this issue from a standpoint of strength and not fear. We should have great confidence in our military forces and in our law enforcement agencies to keep our citizens safe. We don't need to go off half-cocked and start interfering in the defense policy of our country. But Quesada, along with Rep. Rick Womack, another Republican, and at least a few other lawmakers, believe it's time to call a special legislative session to look at doing something. We must do something. I believe we should take a long look at the entire refugee program and use any means necessary to stop refugees from entering Tennessee. Any means necessary to stop refugees. If they come from countries with ties to ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and similar terrorist groups. So now, not just Syrian refugees, any refugees from anywhere, any of these war-torn nations where citizens are being killed and attacked and they face certain death from ISIS, don't let them come here. If the U.S. Supreme Court says the federal government cannot force states to expand their Medicaid rolls, I'm not sure how the federal government believes it can legitimately force Tennessee to accept refugees from countries with known terrorists. You know, we don't have in this country, we don't have borders around the states. And so, you know, when these state governments and all these governors were saying, we're not going to let them in our state, you know, unless they want to start erecting blockades at the borders on the highways. It doesn't matter what you people want in your state. That's not how it works. It works at the federal level. And of course, at the federal level on Thursday, Republicans and 47 Democrats, to their eternal shame, voted in the U.S. House to keep out Syrian refugees. Back to the Tennessean here. Those emotions are sending the legislative conversation in a dangerous direction, according to Senate Democratic Caucus leader Jeff Yarbrough, who ought to talk to his Democratic colleagues, frankly, in the U.S. House. Yarbrough said, we're better than this. After Paris, it makes sense to fear the violence being exported by ISIS, but giving in to fear, closing the borders, abandoning our allies is un-American and ultimately will make our situation even more dangerous. Yarbrough is correct. Senator Bill Ketron of Murfreesboro, Tennessee, said he's crafting legislation aimed at determining how much money refugees cost the state. Ah, we'll make the conservative argument of how much they cost. Okay, good. He said, beyond the urgent public safety concerns, state governments must pay the tab for the refugee needs, like health care, education, and welfare programs. Currently, we do not collect data we need to give us the data that we need to give us that information, Ketron said. The Tennessean, once again, well done, Tennessean. This is Dave Boucher at the Tennessean, said that this is not the first time Ketron has proposed legislation of this nature. Lawmakers have received data showing refugees account for far more revenue than expenses for Tennessee. That's right. In 2013, a report from the State Fiscal Review Committee noted that it's hard to accurately convey the specific economic impact of refugees, but it estimated that refugees represented nearly $1.4 billion in state revenue from 1990 to 2012, compared with at least $753 million spent by the state on refugees and their descendants during the same period. So to do the math very quickly for you there, let's see, that's about $1 billion in income, in revenue overall to the state of Tennessee. Don't tell Republicans in the state of Tennessee, however. Matthew Iglesias on Twitter points out that it is striking how little impact the fact that the Paris attackers were neither Syrian nor refugees is having on the Syrian refugee debate. Well said, Matthew Iglesias. Now, of course, you may wish to laugh and ridicule, make fun and loathe all of these cowardly, un-American, xenophobic, racist, nativist, frightened, opportunistic, disinformed, obnoxious, embarrassing Congress members and state legislators who voted to block Syrian refugees fleeing war and terrorism in their home country, seeking to block them from coming here where they're seeking peace and safety and freedom in our nation. But remember, many of these same great American members of Congress were also the ones who were yelling and screaming and desperately trying to warn us in advance about that U.S. Ebola epidemic that decimated our country just over a year ago. That was almost exactly a year ago, October 2014. And we were told, of course, that what the Obama administration was doing was not sufficient and that nobody should believe the experts and that we were going to be destroyed by this Ebola epidemic what happened to that one? It went away. So all of those same people who are wrong about that, again, we're supposed to look to them now to be right about this. And so, of course, we're looking to Donald Trump, who is now the front runner, clearly, both nationally and in New Hampshire. Since Ben Carson has begun to fade, he's now the front runner, and he is saying that, yes, absolutely, that's a quote, absolutely, we should register all Muslims in this country in a database. On Thursday night, Trump told an NBC reporter that all American Muslims, quote, have to be required. That's a quote, have to be required to register in a database in the wake of the deadly terror attacks in Paris. He said, I would certainly implement that. Absolutely, Trump said when he was asked about forcing registration of the 5 million to 12 million Muslims living in America. Though he backed the idea of registering Muslims in a federal database, the Washington Post points out that Trump has historically opposed the idea of a federal gun owner database. That he's against. He's opposed that sort of database on the grounds that, quote, lawful gun owners will have their privacy invaded and will place information in the hands of government officials that could be easily abused. He shows, of course, no such fear in requiring all Jews to register with the federal government. Oh, wait a minute. No, all Muslims to register with the federal government, that Jews having to register with the federal government, that was a whole different thing, a whole different time, a whole different place. How'd that end up, by the way? The Washington Post asked Trump to clarify why a database of gun sales would be an invasion of privacy and subject to abuse, while those risks don't concern him when it comes to an index of Muslim Americans and migrants. He did not respond. But on Thursday, Trump was unable to say how his Muslim registry would be different from Nazi Germany, from the Nazi Germany policy of forcing Jews to register in a database. The New York Times reports that when asked how a system of registering Muslims would be carried out, whether, for instance, mosques would be where people could register, Mr. Trump said, oh, different places. You sign up at different places. But it's all about management. Our country has no management. Asked later, as he signed autographs, how such a database would be different from Jews having to register in Nazi Germany, Mr. Trump repeatedly said, you tell me. You tell me. Until he stopped responding to the question at all. And it was amazing. You could see in that video, Desi Doyen, I don't know if you saw that video, but you could see that when he was asked that question, suddenly it occurred to him what he had said.
Yeah. I think it was really clear that he suddenly backed off and was considering the wheels were turning in his head really quickly. You could see him thinking about how am I going to get out of this soup?
Yeah. And of course, on Friday morning, Jeb Bush said that Trump's idea to register Muslims was, quote, just wrong. He accused his rival of, quote, manipulating people's angst and their fears. And when a Bush is accusing you of manipulating people's angst and their fears, boy, you must have gone off the rails, man. Bush said, that's not strength, that's weakness. Yeah.
Except Jeb Bush also did back the idea of having only letting in Christian refugees, not Muslim refugees, and he was okay with that.
You could tell. Unbelievable. I've talked about this. I've talked about the gray zone over the past week, what ISIS calls the gray zone, and how dangerous it is, what's going on, and how we are playing exactly into the hands of the very same people, the very same terrorists that these people, you know, are claiming to be fighting against. They are playing into their hands. They are doing exactly what it was that Osama bin Laden wanted and that ISIS wants now. And Sally Steenland and Ken Goody over at Center for American Progress wrote about exactly that on Thursday. And I've talked about it. But let me read it again here. Let me read what they wrote. I haven't read what they wrote, but it's the same thing. The Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, or ISIS, is pursuing a strategy explicitly designed to provoke hostility towards innocent Muslims in Western society in order to radicalize these communities and recruit them to their cause. Listening to the American political debate in the wake of the tragic terrorist attacks in Paris, that strategy may be working, they write. Islamophobic rants are both morally offensive and factually inaccurate and play right into the hands of our terrorist enemies. ISIS is not hiding its objectives. In its publications, they say, it talks of forcing the world into two camps by, quote, destroying the gray zone between itself and the forces aligned against it. For ISIS, the gray zone is inhabited by those who have yet to commit to one side in its clash of civilizations. In the February edition of ISIS's official magazine, Dabiq, an ISIS writer outlines a plan to, quote, compel the crusaders, that's the West, to actively destroy the gray zone themselves, unquote, by generating anti-Muslim hysteria in the wake of terrorism. Attacks such as those in Paris are designed to get Western governments to alienate their Muslim populations and push them towards ISIS. Some conservatives appear happy to oblige. So there you go. There you hear it again. All right. I've got much more on this, and we're going to get to Ian Millhiser shortly. But I want to get to some of the way that CNN, frankly, seems happy to oblige, and some encouraging statements, even from, well, at least one Republican, and even from Stephen Colbert straight ahead. Let's take a quick break, and we will come back with more broadcast right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay tuned. Trouble. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Ian Millhiser coming up very shortly to talk about the his troubling story, the little noticed conservative plan to permanently lock Democrats out of policymaking. But some more on what's been going on over the past week in this country and what's been going on specifically in Congress. Elise Labatte over at CNN was covering this shameful vote on Thursday to block the Syrian refugee program, which is just amazing. In any event, she tweeted out, House passes a bill that could limit Syrian refugees. Statue of Liberty bows head in anguish. Now, that was a pretty mild thing to tweet, frankly, about what has happened. I mean, I think we've spent the last, I don't know how many days talking about this effort to keep Syrians out despite the in the wake of Paris, despite the fact that so far no Syrians even identified with those attacks, much less refugees. But she was suspended for 2 weeks for saying that, for saying the Statue of Liberty bows head in anguish. By way of reminder, for those who don't remember, the Statue of Liberty, a gift from France, actually says on it, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." That's what it says on the Statue of Liberty. Now, CNN suspended her for making that that tweet, which is absolutely amazing to me, given the fact that some of their other journalists, like Don Lemon, the things that he has said, as Eric Wemple points out over at the Washington Post, Lemon, after the protests in Ferguson, Missouri, said, quote, "In my estimation, there's been too much political correctness trying to appease protesters." He was not suspended for that. He said there was nothing peaceful about the Ferguson protests. He was not suspended for that. HuffPo points out that last week, while moderating a discussion with four women on the firing of New York Times executive editor Jill Abramson, this is from a while ago, Lemon said he didn't believe in equal pay for work, equal work in all circumstances. Lemon said he agreed with some criticisms of blacks by Fox News' Bill O'Reilly. Why is Don Lemon allowed to denigrate Ferguson protesters, oppose equal pay, endorse Bill O'Reilly's criticism of black youth, but Elise Labatte is not allowed to sympathize with Syrian refugees? I don't know. You tell me. The policy, apparently, is that so long as he's not predictably partisan, according to CNN, he can say those sorts of things. I don't know that she was predictably partisan in this case. I talked to Don Lemon. Actually, I had criticized Don Lemon back in 2010, took CNN and him to task for this discussion they had about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks and this this graphic they had on the screen that shamefully said, "Assange, journalist or terrorist?" I wrote about it at bradblog.com. And after my critical coverage, Don Lemon gave me a call. He stood by all aspects of that, even though there is no evidence to associate Assange with terrorism. And if he was a terrorist, that would make him a target of this country and many others for assassination. He stood by that. But however, an hour and a half discussion we had on the phone, he would not allow me to share any of his comments. He said they were all off the record. It's funny how journalists are the ones who seem to have the most trouble talking to journalists and going on the record themselves, even while they criticize others for not going on the record. Anyway, well, maybe we'll get into that in more detail at another time. But also CNN's Elise Labatte tweeted on Monday morning that President Barack Obama, when he was speaking at the G20 in Turkey, she tweeted that he was, quote, whining about criticism instead of presenting ideas. And yet she didn't get suspended for that. She only got suspended for talking about the Statue of Liberty hanging its head in anguish. And of course, CNN White House correspondent Jim Acosta, right after the attacks, said to President Obama, "Why can't we take out these bastards?" He didn't get suspended for that either. Anyway, they're all not absolutely insane. This is Congressman, where are we here? Congressman Steve Russell from Oklahoma, Republican from Republican from Oklahoma, during the debate on whether or not to block Syrian refugees from coming into this country. I'm happy to say his statements got it almost completely right.
While I have tried to focus my comments on actions that we should take to eliminate ISIS, one action we should not take is to become like them. America is a lamp that lights the horizon of civilized and free mankind. Statue of Liberty cannot have a stiff arm. Her arm must continue to keep the torch burning brightly. But if we use our passions and our anger and fear, and we use that to snuff out her flame, by xenophobic and knee-jerk policy, the enemy wins. We have played into their hands. Period. Here are some Syrian refugee facts you may not know. Despite a long-established multi-layered system to vet and bring refugees into the United States, despite biometric and biographic screening, despite intelligence vetting with the National Counterterrorism Center, the FBI's Terrorist Screening Center, and the Departments of State, Defense, and Homeland Security, added to the fact that Syrian refugees receive additional screening to national security concerns, and most of them are women and children, coupled with the fact that a total of 1,900 Syrians have entered this country in the last 4 years, most of them women and children. Americans across the country now are calling on Lady Liberty to drop her torch and give the stiff arm with perhaps even another gesture. I want you to listen carefully to these statements by members of Congress in response to a refugee bill. Not an illegal immigration bill or permanent residents, but refugees, a refugee bill. Listen to these comments by members of Congress about people fleeing for their lives. Fighting immigration is the best vote-getting argument. The politician can beat his breast and proclaim his loyalty to America. He can tell the unemployed man that he's out of work because some alien has his job. End quote. Here's another one. Congress must protect the youth of America from this foreign invasion. End quote. And how about this one? American children have first claim to America's charity. End quote. There are many more, but these quotes were from 1939. The refugee bill was not for Muslim and Christian Syrians or Iraqi Muslims, Christians, and Yazidis. It was for German Jews. While it was true that Germany was indeed a threat, the refugees were not. They were 20,000 children. Not only did that bill of 1939 not pass, but that Congress, with the same speech and rhetoric that I've been hearing in recent days in this august chamber, Mr. Speaker, they passed hurdle after hurdle in 1939 to make it more difficult for refugees to enter.
Good for him. That was Congressman Steve Russell, Republican from Oklahoma, during the debate on whether or not to block refugees from Syria from coming into this country. He went on to say that back in 1939, we made it very difficult for those fleeing Nazi Germany to get in. And in fact, we did send many of them back to their deaths. So good for the congressman for those statements, for those words. And then he went on to vote in favor of the legislation to block those Syrian refugees anyway. So I guess we have to turn to the late night comedians to tell us what we really ought to be concerned about in this country. Here's Stephen Colbert on Thursday night on xenophobia, on ISIS, on Trump, on Jeb, and the Statue of Liberty.
Here's the deal. If you want to live in the 7th century, you don't get to be on TV. But after that senseless tragedy, the question of whether to let Syrian refugees into this country has become the new political issue, completely overshadowing the old political issue, whether to let Mexicans into this country. It's all anybody in Washington, on the campaign trail, or on the TV box is talking about. So let's wander blindly onto the news tarmac and get sucked into one of the fear turbines. This afternoon, Congress passed a new bill that will require the nation's top security officials to personally certify that each refugee admitted from Iraq or Syria is not a threat. It's called the American Security Against Foreign Enemies Act, or ASAFEA. Because under the law, no one with a name like that will be allowed in the country. Besides, presidential candidate and man whose hair is a refugee from his scalp, Donald Trump, isn't even sure they'd want to live here.
The weather. A friend of mine lives in Minnesota, and he calls me and says, can you imagine it's 130 degrees in Syria, and now they want to send some up to Minnesota where it's 30 degrees. But these people are going to be very, very unhappy. It's cold and beautiful, but it's cold. You keep them in Syria, the weather's the same.
Yeah, it's a tough call for the refugees. I mean, do I want to stay in a war zone where my family faces almost certain death, or do I want to go somewhere where I have to put on a jacket before I go to the mall? I mean, you're walking around carrying your coat, you get all sweaty, you go outside, you forget to put it on, then you get a cold. I'll take my chances with ISIS. And this kind of selective immigration is nothing new. Like the plaque on the Statue of Liberty says, give us your tired, your poor, mostly Christians, maybe one or two Indian guys with engineering degrees. And when Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz say only let in Christians, it's just because they don't know if they can trust Syrian Muslims, but they do know they can relate to your average Syrian Christians. Jeb Bush has the answer.
What does the focus on Christian families actually look like? Is that going to...
You're a Christian. I mean, you can prove you're a Christian. It's the...
How?
I think you can prove it.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to know if somebody is Christian, just ask them to complete this sentence. Jesus said, I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you... And if they don't say, welcomed me in, they are either a terrorist or they are running for president.
Thank you, Stephen Colbert. A quick break, and we're back with more broadcast, and Ian Millhiser will be joining us. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com, trying desperately to keep our eyes on things that matter today, even with so much that's going on around the world, so much that's very troubling going on around the world. But policy matters continue here in the U.S., whether we are talking about them or not, whether they're showing up on our news reports right now. We are looking not just at an election year ahead, not just a horse race, but a horse race that will have very serious consequences, and frankly, serious consequences no matter how it ends up playing out. We've talked on this show for a long time about how gerrymandering and voter suppression and so forth has made it very difficult for Democrats to regain control of the U.S. House, and that will likely be the case again next year as even if they win the popular vote, Congress will most likely not end up with a Democratic majority. We've seen this before. I think it was in 2012. Far more Americans voted for Democrats to go to the Congress, and yet Republicans held on to the majority because of the way they have gerrymandered those congressional districts. In the meantime, a group named the Federalist Society, a rather powerful conservative organization that we'll explain in detail exactly who these guys are in a moment, recently held its annual meeting where, as Ian Millhiser writes at Think Progress, their disturbing proposals this year, quote, would take a system that has already been rigged by factors such as voter suppression laws and gerrymandering and rig it even more, so that Democrats cannot make policy even when they do earn the mandate of the people. Now, these proposals that were coming up this year at the Federalist Society that we'll talk about in a moment have to do a lot with not only undoing certain regulations, federal regulations, but also making it nearly impossible for the White House, no matter who's in charge, I suppose, but certainly if Democrats are in charge, to create any new ones. And if you don't think that's disturbing, I will remind you what Jeb Bush had to say at a recent GOP debate when he was asked which of the Obama administration's regulations he would like to roll back.
On the regulatory side, I think we need to repeal every rule that Barack Obama has in terms of work in progress. Every one of them. And start over. For those that are already in existence, the regulation of the internet, we have to start over, but we ought to do that. The Clean Power Act, we ought to repeal that and start over on that. The Waters of the United States Act, which is going to be devastating for agriculture and many industries, we should repeal that. We should repeal the rules because the economic costs of this far exceed the social benefit. And if we're serious about being serious about high growth, then we have to recognize that small businesses right now, more of them are closing than are being set up.
Now, Jeb Bush, of course, wasn't the only one who was talking about repealing rules. A number of the candidates were actually referring to rules made by the White House, actually made by the executive branch agencies, as things they could repeal, as if they were laws. It doesn't exactly work that way. But the point being, they don't like the regulations. They've already stopped new laws of any type from being able to go through. Now they're going into the executive rulemaking that is carried out by federal agencies as they try to implement the laws that have been passed by Congress. Anyway, here to talk about all of this and the disturbing new proposals coming out of the Federalist Society's annual convention is our friend Ian Millhiser, a constitutional law expert and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and the editor of Think Progress Justice. His writings have appeared in legal and mainstream publications from coast to coast, including the New York Times, LA Times, U.S. News and World Report, Slate, The Guardian, American Prospect, the Yale Law and Policy Review, and the Duke Law Journal. His first book is Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted, which I believe is now available for purchase. Hey, Ian Millhiser, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Good to be back. Thanks so much.
And I just want to make sure that book, Injustices, is now published, is now available for purchase, right?
It is indeed. Yeah, no, please, go get it on Amazon. Go get it at, your local bookstore. You can hear all about the terrible things that the Supreme Court has done to this country.
Well done. It is Black Friday coming up after all. It sounds like it would make a fine Christmas gift for one and all. Okay. You write at Think Progress here's the headline: the little noticed conservative plan to permanently lock Democrats out of policymaking. Wow, quite a headline. Caught my eye, at least. That sounds troubling. I want to discuss that in a moment. But first, to help us understand all of this, what exactly, Ian, is the Federalist Society, and why should we care what they're up to and what they're talking about at their annual conventions that I understand you attended recently?
Yeah, so the Federalist Society is kind of an alternative bar association for conservative lawyers. So conservative attorneys get together, some of them very powerful. This includes three sitting Supreme Court justices who are members of the society. This includes a number of senators and other members of Congress. This includes a ton of judges. Mm-hmm. So they get together, and often this conference they throw every year is when they then speak to their membership and tell them, here are the ideas that our conservative legal community has come up with for how we want to try to use whatever branch of government will listen to us to get our policies enacted.
Hmm. Now,
this year...
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, now, isn't that the very definition of activist courts, activist judges? In other words, they're not saying each case shall be determined by the law. Rather, they are saying, hey, how can we use these courts to make law and to change law?
Right.
Isn't that what's going on? And isn't that exactly what these Republicans actually pretend to decry when courts make decisions they don't like?
Well, yeah, there's no question that they take a by any means necessary approach to policymaking. If they can get something through Congress and get the president to sign it, they'll do it that way. And if that won't work, they'll try to pass something through the regulatory process. If that won't work, they'll try to get a state to do it. If that won't work, they'll sue and try to get the court to do it. I mean, these are folks who very conservative agenda. Many of them are extraordinarily skilled and talented lawyers, and they know how to manipulate the levers of power to get the results that they want.
And you mentioned that there are three Supreme Court justices now on the court. Our legal analyst at Bradblog, Ernie Canning, has written about these guys for years, the Federalists on the court. He describes them as radicals in robes, and he has warned ominously about them. Is that an accurate description as you see it? And how closely should membership in the group in the Federalist Society, you know, for these judges, for these federally appointed judges, how closely should that be seen as a sign on how they might decide cases? Are they, in other words, are they really doing the bidding of the Federalist Society when these members get appointed to the bench?
I mean, I can only speculate as to, you know, to what extent they are being influenced by what they hear at the Federalist Society, as opposed to just they already hold these views already.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, the three justices we're talking about here, Justice Scalia, Thomas, and Alito, you know, the example that just makes me question how they understand their role as a judge is there was a case just last term, King v. Burwell, that tried to take out the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
It was based on the theory that much of the text of the Affordable Care Act doesn't count, and we should just read one sentence to the exclusion of everything else in the law, including provisions of the law that define the words in that sentence. Now, no one, including Justice Scalia in his own writing, has said that that's an appropriate way to read a law, and yet those three justices, over the objections of the other six members of the court, wanted to dismantle, in fact, worse than dismantle, much of the Affordable Care Act, to transform it into a weapon that would destroy a lot of states' health insurance market. And they did it based on this legal theory that comports with no legitimate notion of how statutes should be read that had existed prior to this case.
And that legal theory came out of the Federalist Society?
It did indeed, yeah. It came out, it was certainly popularized within the Federalist Society. So it was, a conservative lawyer who, you know, who was actually very obscure. He was a partner in some law firm somewhere, you know, came up with this idea, and it was incubated in conservative think tanks, and it was popularized through the Federalist Society, and it was spread throughout the conservative legal community through the Federalist Society, and one of its the biggest evangelist for this theory was a Federalist Society member, so they are very involved in, spreading the gospel of whatever it is that conservative lawyers think they can do in order to move the law in a more conservative direction.
You write that past convention speakers offered proposals as ambitious as eliminating anti-discrimination law. Well, we saw that recently down in Houston, eliminating the minimum wage, declaring much of the 20th century unconstitutional. And this year's convention, you say, also talked about ideas such as eliminating unions and protecting anti-gay discrimination. But you say that there was one topic that came up over and over again, so much that you, what'd you say, this year's convention schedule was planned. It appeared to be planned by Captain Ahab, with the Obama administration's regulations playing the role of Moby Dick. What is that about? What is this attack on regulations that they were talking about, and how, as you describe, would this permanently lock Democrats out of policymaking?
Sure. So, I mean, there are a ton of federal laws that delegate the power to determine the details of how that law will be implemented to a federal agency. So, like, you know, think of the Federal Clean Air Act.
Right.
You know, Congress can't just pass a law saying pollution is banned and be done with it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of very particular determinations that require expertise that has to be made. You have to determine which pollutants are actually likely to harm people's health.
Mm-hmm.
You have to determine what the sources of those pollutants are. You have to determine, you know, what methods of regulating those sources make sense. And, you know, these are things that require a great deal of expertise. So we have an entire agency, the Environmental Protection Agency, that possesses expertise in that space, and they come up with details of these rules.
So rather than rather, for example, rather than in the law itself, in the Clean Air Act itself, rather than go through and list, what pollutants need to be done away with or how much of that pollutant is a worry, they basically say this Clean Air Act has the EPA, instructs the EPA to come up with a list of these pollutants and take action to stop them. And then it leaves that rulemaking to the EPA itself rather than having it in legislation, in the actual Clean Air Act.
It has a little more guidance than that, but that's the basic idea.
Okay.
The basic idea is that, we might discover tomorrow that some ordinary chemical that's been in our car exhaust for 50 years is actually very, very dangerous, and we just didn't realize it before.
Right.
And so we want, the EPA to be nimble and be able to decide, we have new information, we have new science, and we want to regulate our exhaust tube now so that chemical is no longer a problem.
Mm-hmm.
We might also discover that there's a cheaper and more efficient way to regulate emissions. We might discover that a chemical that we previously believed to be very harmful is actually not as harmful as we want it to be,
mm-hmm.
and so it makes sense to deregulate in that case.
So the EPA can do that on their own rather than having to wait for the entire process to go through to make a new law in both houses of Congress, signed it by the White House. The EPA is charged with making those decisions. And similarly, with you cite the Affordable Care Act. Obamacare is another example.
That's right. I mean, much of the Affordable Care Act, your health plan, if you have an employer-provided health plan, it has to cover certain preventative services, and much of the details of which services have to be covered are determined by the Department of Health and Human Services, because Congress has delegated that power to them.
Okay, and that is now what this Federalist Society says we have to do away with. It's not enough that we've made it impossible, by and large, to pass any new laws with a broken Congress, but now we're going to stop federal agencies, take away the rulemaking power from these federal agencies?
Yeah, I mean, they have various ideas. One of them is to have no regulation is allowed to go into effect unless Congress affirmatively approves it within 70 days. And given the fact that our Congress can't even figure out how to fund the government, that's unlikely to happen very, very often at all. They have various theories for declaring all these regulations unconstitutional, for eliminating the amount of deference that the judiciary is supposed to give to the agencies. And so they have all sorts of different details to their proposals, but the basic idea is to shut down the agency's power to regulate. And they want to do that for two reasons. I mean, one is that, a lot of these folks don't much like the EPA, they don't much like the Affordable Care Act, so they'd be happy to see them gone.
Right.
But the other reason, it goes to something you said in your introduction, which is that because our system is, between gerrymandering and so many other factors, it's so difficult for Democrats to take the House. If they can prevent the agencies from regulating, then that means that while Democrats might be able to take the presidency, they won't be able to do anything with it when they have it. And it effectively shuts the Democratic Party out of the policymaking process, even when they win the presidential election.
So, because right now, for example, Barack Obama has said, and it took him too many years to do this, in my opinion, but he has said, look, if I can't get the Congress to pass these laws, immigration, and climate and so forth, then I will take action on my own. And that's exactly what he's talking about, right? Executive agencies and their rulemaking power. And that's now that they've broken Congress, these Republicans, or at least these folks in the Federalist Society, are now trying to keep the president from being able to even do that, even change federal rules.
Right. And it's important to keep in mind that, for the most part, the reason why the president's able to act, I mean, there are a few areas where the president has power, regardless of what Congress has done.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, the reason why the president or the administration is able to take actions like health care or the environment is because Congress has already passed the law. So Congress passed the Clean Air Act, and the Clean Air Act already gives Obama and already gives the Obama administration a fair amount of ability to regulate emissions and try to fight things like global warming. Now, Republicans may not like that fact,
mm-hmm.
But their remedy is they have to repeal that law. You know, if they try to strip the president of his ability to regulate, you know, using the powers that he's given, then what they're effectively doing is crossing out a law that has already been passed, and you know that isn't something that you know should be doable without another act of Congress.
And yet, this is not, it would be nice to say, oh, this is just a bunch of, sort of extremist right-wingers. None of this is actually going to happen. None of this is going to come to pass. But you've got, I think it was Carly Fiorina, for example, who in the recent GOP debates, she cited the RAINS Act as something that we need to pass. And so this is not just some, extremist a fringe group. This is, coming up in the presidential debate, Carly Fiorina saying, let's pass the RAINS Act. What is the RAINS Act? And how would that effectively result in a massive shift in power from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party, as you write, Ian Millhiser?
Yeah, so the RAINS Act is the legislative version of this anti-regulatory agenda. That's the bill that says that many regulations automatic, or like they don't go into effect at all, actually, unless Congress affirmatively votes them up within 70 days. So that's the legislative version of this broader agenda. But I mean, they don't actually even need to pass a bill if they use other laws of power. I mean, the big scary is that there are 4 Supreme Court justices who are likely to retire in the next 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
So if the next president gets to replace 4 justices, there's going to be a massive shift in the law. If that next president appoints 4 very conservative justices, 4 justices in the vein of Justice Samuel Alito,
uh-huh,
then whatever agenda the Federalist Society wants to be able to enact in this space, they're probably just going to be able to enact it in the court.
And so the fear would be, and I think this comes to the you write about as the Chevron doctrine, but the fear would be that the court basically comes in and says, well, yes, Congress passed that law, but they didn't say this specific thing or that specific thing, and therefore we are going to decide that the rulemaking power of this federal agency is no longer valid. They don't have the right, the ability to lock this right. rule in as law because Congress didn't specifically spell it out. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, I mean, some of these folks want to declare the Clean Air Act unconstitutional. They want to say that it is illegal, it was unconstitutional for Congress to make the kind of delegation that it made in the Clean Air Act, which would make environmental policy nearly impossible. You know, it would be that every time there's a new scientific development in this, field where there's vastly, there's a great deal mm-hmm. of dynamicism in the science. Every time there's a new scientific development, if we want to react to it, we have to get a new bill through Congress and, get a new bill through a Congress that can't even decide to raise the debt ceiling. That's the, probably the worst case scenario, is that they try to permanently hobble the federal, not just the federal rulemaking process, the federal lawmaking process, by making laws like the Clean Air Act impossible.
And we're talking about thousands and thousands of rules and regulations, large and small, that are decided by these federal agencies. And of course, Republicans complain, oh, there's too many rules and regulations and so forth. So this is a way to do away with that and to basically keep the federal government, frankly, from being able to do anything. Right now, Ian Millhiser, they rely on the courts tend to rely on what's called the Chevron doctrine. What exactly is the Chevron doctrine?
Yeah, so Chevron was a decision from the 1980s, which just said that generally courts owe a great deal of deference to agencies when they engage in the rulemaking process. So the agencies have a great deal of expertise in their particular issue mm-hmm. space. The courts typically do not. I mean, what does Sam Alito know about environmental policy? Next
right.
to nothing. And so we would rather have the experts that Congress gave this role to making these decisions than 9 people with black robes and law degrees.
So they tend to They have a deference to the, if there's a question about a specific rule, if the agency, the federal agency in question is supporting it, is coming to court and saying, yes, here's why we need this. Here's the scientific basis for it. You know, in the case of the EPA, for example, then they tend to defer to that agency. That federal agency tends to have power over what any particular court might say.
Yeah, I mean, it's generally deference to the agency's interpretation of the law. So if the law is ambiguous, if it's unclear when, like, the law says, for example, that, you know, the EPA has the power to regulate pollution, that, like, a particular kind of emission is indeed qualifies as a pollutant, the agency will, or the court will typically defer to the agency in that space. You know, and a big reason for this is because the EPA is just going to know more about what about pollution.
Yeah, of course. And yet, even that needs to be undermined, it seems, by this group. How worried should we be? We've got just a minute or so here, Ian. How worried should we be about what we hear, what you heard, you know, at these conferences, as far as, you know, how often do these ideas make their way from these annual conferences that really few in the corporate media pay attention to, from those conferences to actual policy, whether it be on the courts or in the legislative bodies around the country?
Well, here's the thing. Like, my entire life, we've had an election every 2 years. We have a presidential election every 4 years. And what that meant is that if you won the presidential election, you got some power to govern. And then 4 years later, if people didn't like what you did, they had the opportunity to change the nation's course. And what groups like the Federalist Society are pushing, and there are a lot of folks in the conservative community who are behind this agenda, is they're looking for ways to change the fact that elections matter, to make it so that they can permanently put in place structures, whether it's declaring things unconstitutional, whether it's changing the balance of power between the various branches of government. They're looking to permanently put in place structures to make sure that only conservative policies can go into effect.
All very troubling, as it is every time you show up on this program, Ian. The little-noticed conservative plan to permanently lock Democrats out of policymaking, check it out at thinkprogress.org. And as always, you can and should follow Ian's work over there at Climate Justice. Go to thinkprogress.org for more, or follow him on the Twitters at imilheiser.com. Or even better yet, for Christmas, make Ian's holiday by going out and buying his new book, Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Ian, thanks as ever for joining us, and have a happy holiday.
All right, thanks so much. I'll talk to you later.
Okay, only time to offer a quick thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn, and, of course, to Ian Milheiser. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it at bradblog.com, and you can yell at me about it at on the Twitters and the Facebooks at The Brad Blog. All right, we will see you soon. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.